Next seat, everybody. All right, we are here this morning for argument in case numbers 84647 and 85538, Aguilar versus Lucky Cab et al. Everyone ready to proceed this morning? All right, so Mr. Cogburn, come on up and I guess tell me if you'd like to reserve any time for rebuttal.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
3 minutes, okay, so you probably know this, but that just means the all lights and gonna come on and a tone's gonna happen at 3 minutes, but the time's gonna keep running until you step away.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. The main issue, the issue on appeal here is whether in an offer of judgment is the appellant entitled to cost, prejudgment interest, possibly attorney's fees, when an offer of judgment, it says it's exclusive of those items. And in other words, you have to ask yourself, do words matter? And specifically, do the words exclusive or inclusive matter when you're dealing with an offer of judgment? And I want to go through a quick history of Rule 68 briefly, because it does matter as we've moved along. 1998, the language then was offer with accrued cost. And then in 1998, we came along and had major changes. And that's when we added specific language, which is taken in accordance with its terms and conditions, which means the party who was making the offer really became the master of their offer. And they could add different language. In addition, they added language that allowed the party making the offer to pay the offer within a reasonable time period rather than having a judgment entered. Now, in 2019, we come along, so 30 years later, and more language is added, and it was there to clarify. And when you look at Section A of NRCP 68, it still has taken in accordance with its terms and conditions, but added, unless otherwise specified, and that's what's key, an offer made under this rule is an offer to resolve all claims in the action between the parties to the date of the offer, including costs, expenses, interests, and if any attorney's fees are permitted by law or contract, attorney's fees. And then it added Section D2, which allows if they pay within 21 days rather than a reasonable time period, to have dismissal of the complaint rather than a judgment entered.
Mr. Cogburn, how do you interpret the fact that the rule in 1 and 2 is different, sub D 1 and 2 is different than 3? So 3 allows costs, or the court must allow costs, but the two sections regarding the dismissal of Section 2 does not allow costs.
That's a very good question. If the judgment
wasn't at all, it was
well,
very
I understand what you're trying to say, though, because there is some discrepancy. And ultimately, Section 3 there is if judgment is entered, the court must allow it. But you have to go back and you have to read the rule as a whole. And when you read the rule as a whole, the offer is made. And in this case, the offer was made $150,000 exclusive of interest, cost, and attorney's fees. And we're going to ignore attorney's fees for our purposes because there was no claim that we're entitled to attorney's fees. That means that if you cannot agree in that time period, the 21 days, interest is easily calculable. We know what the date of the complaint was, the date it was served, and what the amount is. So that everybody can calculate that.
But you don't know whether or not some of that's future costs, future expenses.
Well, can you clarify that?
On prejudgment interest, there may be like a future medical procedure or something like that that would not bear prejudgment interest.
That is correct. But if you accept the offer, when the person making the offer, the party making the offer, is going to know if they accept the offer, this is the amount of interest that I would be required to pay if it's exclusive of interest, because we would take the $150,000, whatever the interest rate is, by the date of the calculated by the date the summons was served. And you have the days to calculate.
I guess just in the trying to be simple, like offers of judgment are a tool towards settlement, to simplification and cut off litigation, court expense, party expense, everything. And if you're going to end up with a dispute about whether or not there's how you divide up prejudgment interest, which unlike taxable costs depends on the claims, you're always going to have to be sorting out the principal amount and how much of the judgment, if we credit your reading, was for claims that bear prejudgment interest as opposed to those that are limited to post.
And that's a fair question, but if you accept the offer of a judgment, it's all prejudgment interest at that point, because there is no post-judgment interest that's going to accrue because you've accepted the offer, the judgment.
Well, but there might well be an enormous medical procedure in the plaintiff's future that would not bear interest even if included in the judgment at that point.
But at that point, it's on the plaintiff whether there is no allocation because of the offer of judgment in any settlement. So if you just take a regular settlement agreement, they don't allocate right. And say, hey, this much is for pain and suffering, this much is for medical bills passed.
But by your reading of this statute, you're saying you want us to, if they say exclusive of interest and costs, you want us to have the court figure out what the interest is and add it to the amount that was offered. My point is, how do you even know whether what that lump sum offer was for in calculating interest? You don't.
You don't. You absolutely do not. You know that it's to resolve the entire case. And with the new rule, especially as the rule is amended to 2019, they really made it clear, because there was litigation in the past of, when you look at Clark versus Lubritz, whether an offer of judgment is valid if it does not resolve the entire case. So here, the rule, when it amended in 2019, really made it clear, this is to resolve the entire case, unless you otherwise specify. And that goes back to, you are the master of your offer. You can make an offer of judgment and say, hey, it's $150,000. Exclusive of interest, so you could petition for prejudgment interest on that $150,000, but costs are limited to $20,000 that are still subject to being retaxed by the court. You control your offer, and the contract principles still apply to offers of judgment, which is, if there is any ambiguity, it's construed against the drafter, again, because you're the master of your offer.
To go to Justice Pickering's question, is there anything that would preclude a defendant from making an offer that was, say, $100,000 for past pain and suffering and $50,000 for future medical expenses?
That is a very good question. And I will frankly, my gut reaction is, I do not think so under the new rule. It used to be that you could not make conditioned offers. So the conditions, because you're talking about a future, and I forget the name of the case that dealt with, you give me clear titles to the vehicle and I will pay you $10,000. That offer of judgment was considered invalid. But now with the rules as it amended over time, you really do control your own offer. So you could say, hey, this is $100,000 to past pain and suffering. This is to future pain and suffering. And that part, I would lean to say that it would not, that $50,000 would not be subject to past or prejudgment interest.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm worried we're going to run out of time. So I apologize to my colleagues as well as to you. So let's assume then, in this case, and it says exclusive of the interest and costs, and your client is then seeking to have interest and costs, what's going to happen in that 21 days to allow them to resolve that and get the dismissal that the rule contemplates, D2 contemplates, and what should happen if there's a dispute?
So that is a great question. What has ordinarily always happened in the past that I've always dealt with is the parties will agree on the interest. And we've always taken, hey, it's $150,000 from the date of service, this was the non-interest. And in fact, in our acceptance of the offer of judgment, we put exactly what their interest was through a certain date. Yeah. Costs are a different issue, because when you make an offer exclusive of cost, you have no idea what the other side's costs are. You would try to work with opposing counsel to try to work that out. And they would say, hey, those costs are a little bit higher. And if you cannot agree, it would be entered, the judgment would be entered, but the judgment is entered, or the acceptance is entered, and it is entered for excuse me, I'll pull the language real quick. But it's specifically for purposes of the settlement, and there is no admission of liability still. And the court would then...
So if the parties couldn't work it out, there would have to be a judgment entered rather than the dismissal?
I believe so. And the court would... You would file your memorandum of cost. The other... The responding side would file a motion to retax those costs, and the court would decide what is fair, reasonable cost, and what are allocatable costs.
Quickly, I want to confirm that you recognize this offer was only made under NRCP 68 and doesn't cross-reference 17117.
That is correct.
Do you see any analytical difference how this would come out had it been under 117?
Ultimately, I think you have to read those together, so I do not. I will note that the district court below really referenced in federal court, and a lot of the reliance was upon federal court, which is a very different methodology on how it's calculated. When you accept an offer of judgment, judgment is entered immediately. The clerk enters judgment that day. But as you go back, and you go back 40 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, hey, it's how you write your offer. If you write it exclusive of cost, it's exclusive of cost, and the court will determine cost. If you write it inclusive, it's
right,
inclusive.
Right, but they don't have the interest provision on top of it. They're just dealing with taxable costs, right?
That is correct. In federal. Now, as we've progressed in our own state court, and Mr. Eisenberg will be well aware of the Albios case, that one specifically said, hey, you can make an offer exclusive of interest costs and attorney's fees. And in that case, they made it exclusive of interest. Interest. And on appeal, it was decided that, hey, that was proper, and costs and attorney's fees could be awarded because it was exclusive of that. Now, there was other issues in that appeal also because it was construction defect, but the same principles apply. The one thing that came up in the respondent's brief was, well, it says lump sum of $150,000. And that can lead to some ambiguity because lump sum historically has meant all inclusive. The problem is they want to take lump sum, and for the purposes of the offer of judgment, they want, at the time you accept it, the lump sum, even though it says exclusive, they really want to be inclusive. They're saying it's not exclusive of fees, costs, and interest. It's inclusive because the maximum you can get is $150,000. But if we go to trial, they want to say, hey, it's not inclusive. It was exclusive. So we only have to beat $150,000 because we said it was exclusive of fees, costs, and interest, which means you can't add those amounts to the underlying verdict. For example, if I got a $100,000 verdict and I add my prejudgment interest and costs, I would beat the $150,000 judgment. They're trying to have their cake and eat it too, which is ultimately it's unfair. And you want to make it inclusive in one realm where it benefits you and exclusive in the other. And ultimately, again, it goes back to you are the master of your offer.
But if we didn't have all of this overlay of cases and rules and statutes and repeals and deviation from federal blah blah blah, a normal person just reading this offer of judgment would think I get $150,000 and no more, $1 more. But it's lump sum, and it's exclusive of fees and costs.
I would disagree because when you have a regular layperson, I would agree, but when you're dealing with attorneys that, unfortunately, as we all know, the offer of judgment has been litigated endlessly, unfortunately.
So the words have become terms of art and have meaning, is your point.
Right. And stating that it's exclusive is a key factor when you're talking about offers of judgment. And with that, I would submit and I'll come back with my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Eisenberg on behalf of the respondents. Most offer of judgment cases that involve this kind of a dispute occur after the trial when there's been a verdict, and you have to take the interest, costs, attorney's fees, compare it with the verdict, compare it with the offer of judgment, and it's kind of chaos. But this case was unusual, and the district judge recognized that. The district judge said that this was a unique circumstances because here the offer was accepted. And so all you have to really do is look at Rule 68 and the offer of judgment. The district judge found that both of those were unambiguous, and particularly the offer of judgment was unambiguous. And the plaintiffs here have not really challenged that finding. So why was the offer of judgment here unambiguous? There are really four reasons. First, the amount of the offer stated in the offer of judgment was $150,001. There was no other number in the offer of judgment. Number two, the offer of judgment said that it was for the total lump sum of $150,001. Now, counsel says, well, the word lump sum doesn't really mean lump sum, but this one said total lump sum, $150,001. Third, this offer of judgment said that...
It also said exclusive of interest, fees, and costs, which to me would say that it's the total lump sum, so it's pain and suffering, medical, all of those things together, but not including interest, costs, or fees.
Correct. And if it's accepted, then the total lump sum we're going to pay is $150,001, inclusive.
But if it wasn't accepted, your client would be arguing at the end of the case that, in fact, it was an exclusive offer and that they shouldn't be taking off those amounts, that you should compare it to the whole $150,000, right?
Well, they would, at the end of the case, they would look at the verdict, and the defense would argue, look,
and compare it to the offer.
If the verdict was not more than $150,000, then the defense prevailed.
Right. And so they would be arguing that under 68G, that the offer provided that cost, expenses, interest, and fees would be added by the court, and therefore get the benefit of that at that point. That's what your client argued to the district court, that that's what would happen if it wasn't accepted.
If it was not accepted?
Right.
Yes, but the penalty provision under Rule 68 only applies if it's not accepted.
I understand that, but the but the way that the calculation would be done in that circumstance would be based on the offer having provided that interest and costs would be added by the court, right?
Unless the offer of judgment clearly indicates otherwise, which in this case we believe it did.
So you're now arguing this was an inclusive offer?
It was a total lump sum offer of $150,000.
Does that mean it was an inclusive offer?
It was excluding, it said that it excluded any.
Right.
Which I think fairly clearly under these circumstances, particularly when the offer of judgment said that it was, the purpose was to buy peace, which would be to end the litigation, so that if there was, it was $150,001, and that would be the end of it, that there would be no additional attorney's fees, costs, or interest.
What is the meaning of the offer to resolve it for $150,001, which amount excludes prejudgment interest, attorney's fees, and costs incurred to date?
Well, in the context of the offer, when it's a lump, a total lump sum offer intended to buy peace with a dismissal if it's accepted, then that would seem to indicate that it's $150,001, excluding any additional award of attorney's fees, costs, or interest. So,
so that would mean it's an inclusive offer.
No, it excludes any additional amounts. So that if you, the plaintiff, accept this total lump sum offer that says it's intended to buy peace, and it's, and if you accept it, we are going to go down and get a dismissal under Rule 68D2, I think it is, then that clearly indicates if you accept this offer, that's all you get. We're going to send you a check.
So for what would it mean if it said inclusive of fees and costs?
Well, that would have to be calculated in at the end of the trial. How would it, when the jury returned the verdict?
Right, but in terms of the offer of judgment, those words have meaning pre the end of a trial. So, I mean, what would be the difference then between the term inclusive and the term exclusive?
I apologize, Your Honor. I had a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
It's okay. So under your interpretation of the word exclusive, I'm just trying to understand the difference between the word exclusive and the word inclusive. because it seems like you're defining them in the same way.
Well, our position is basically that that whole dispute is something that would be resolved at the end of the trial. That's when you have to do, if it's rejected, you have to do that comparison at the end. And that's when you determine whether the inclusive or exclusive compared.
But there's a math advantage that you're trying to take. And I think let's do it in numbers. As of the date you made the offer, you are offering $150,000. Let's skip the one. Let's say as of that date, it's $60,000 of costs and interest. That's roughly what he tried to tack on and your client objected to. His point is that the way you're doing this, if you say exclusive of interest, fees, and costs, you want to pay $150,000 today that is in reality $90,000 less some subtraction math. So you'd like to pay 90 plus 60 in interest and costs. But then when the time came come, if he rejects the offer and you want to take the measure, you'd like to get out without interest and costs in terms of valuing the verdict. So you want him to have to get more than 150 at verdict time in order to beat your offer and escape the penalties. So I think his point is you're trying to have it for the price of 90, you're trying to get penalties measured against 150 down the road, and he thinks that's unfair. That's my understanding of the math.
Well, and I would respectfully disagree, because what we're talking about here is, I guess, comparing apples to oranges, what happens at the end of the trial, and this one was accepted. And the purpose of an offer of judgment is to settle a case. And this one was to buy peace for a total amount, total lump sum of $150,000.
Well, but the reason there's a difference at the end of the case is because there's a difference in what would happen if the offer were actually accepted. That's the reason why there's a difference at the end of the case.
But if it's accepted, then it's crystal clear what happens under the offer, because it, as the district judge determined, it was unambiguous, and that finding has not been challenged.
And in fairness, the rule does make this distinction between like how you calculate it at the end of the case, and that you have the opportunity, and this is where we went away from federal in whenever it was, 1998, and we say, okay, we're going to let you have this 14-day or 21-day grace period if you pay up. And you pay your money, you get out, there's no judgment. And I think you're arguing that that means that if you pay, none of the costs and interest would be tacked on anyway. Is that right?
If you pay, if it's accepted?
Yes.
Yes. And what the penalty provision you're talking about comes into play only if it's not accepted and it goes to trial.
Is this an offer in a set amount that precluded a separate award of costs and interest?
We believe it did because of the language. It was unambiguous. It was for a lump sum to buy peace, $150,000, and it said, if this is accepted, we will pay the amount indicated in this offer, which was $150,001, to obtain a dismissal.
So this is an offer in a set amount that precluded a separate award of costs and interest. Is that your position today?
That's our position, because
that's
the
opposite of the position that was taken in district court.
Well, no, it's always been the defense position.
Your client's attorney in district court said at the end of the case, if this offer were not accepted, it would be treated as if those amounts would be added on, so that's why you wouldn't be subtracting the amounts from the $150,000 at that point to make the comparison.
Well, sure, that's how you determine at the end of the case if the party who made the offer prevailed. But when it's accepted, the rule specifically says that a party can phrase the offer of judgment any way the party wants to.
Absolutely. So how did your client phrase it?
He phrased it as a total lump sum amount, one number in it, $150,001, intended to buy peace, and it said, if this is accepted, we will pay the amount stated herein which was $150,001 in order to obtain a dismissal.
So the costs aren't included in the offer, and your client wasn't going to pay the costs. So in other words, it's an potentially impermissible offer that doesn't include costs or allow a separate award of costs. There's no cost either way.
Well, as I said, the rule allows a party to phrase an offer, basically in any way that party wants to.
But Mr. Eisenberg, then couldn't your client have written the offer of judgment to be inclusive of fees and costs, or specified an amount for the fees, costs, interest?
Well, I guess the question is, was there something in this offer that suggested that they were willing to pay more than $150,001 to settle this case? And the answer to that is no. The district judge found this was unambiguous. And that finding really, as I said, has not been challenged. And so the way
this amount if it excludes interest and cost, i.e. it does not include them, it excludes them. What does that mean then?
It means if you accept this, we're going to pay you $150,001, and that's it.
And if it said it includes interest and cost, then what would it mean?
Then at the end of the trial, that would have to be determined if it was rejected. But this one was accepted, and it was accepted under Rule 68D2, and therefore entitled the defendant to a dismissal.
Where in our rule is there any provision for the district court judge to add interest, costs, attorney's fees to an accepted offer? I'm struggling to even find that in our rule. In federal, it's pretty clear that they can add the costs on if the offer didn't cover them, but the preference is for it to be treated as a lump sum because we're trying to settle the case and have everyone go home without further litigation. But our rule, I don't see where the court in dealing with an accepted offer that results in a dismissal, what's the vehicle that would allow the court to add interest to that accepted?
There isn't, and that goes back to Judge Bell's question a long time ago, the difference between subsections 2 and 3. Subsection 3 says if the money isn't paid and you get a judgment, then you have an opportunity to file a motion for costs under 18.110.
18.110, yeah.
But subsection 2 doesn't contain that provision. It says if you pay the money, the amount of the offer or judgment, if you pay it within 21 days, then you get a dismissal, and there's no provision in it for costs. And as we argued in the brief, when something is
and
in
a dismissal
one part
favors your client in this instance, so if there were to be taxable costs, it would run in your favor, right? Because the complaint's being dismissed as against you.
Well,
sort of.
Yeah, I guess, are you asking, could we have made a motion for costs when they accepted the offer? I don't know if that's really what you're asking, but no.
I think you're trying to, your offer is sort of ambiguous, although both of you say it's unambiguous.
Well, and Mr. Eisenberg, to that point, the district court originally found that because the offer was made exclusive of attorney's fees, costs, and interest, it did not prohibit the plaintiff from recovering the interest if he can show he's entitled to those things, right? So I'm not sure that saying that it is unambiguous.
Well, to some extent, Your Honor, the judge bifurcated the dismissal and the claim for costs. At the end of the order where she dismissed the case, she said, okay, I'm paraphrasing here, leave the door open for a motion to cost. For costs, and she asked for a supplemental briefing, which the parties submitted, and there was also a motion for costs. And then she determined that the plaintiff was not the prevailing party because the case had been dismissed with prejudice, and the plaintiffs never challenged the with prejudice determination. So this case was dismissed. They weren't the prevailing party under prevailing case law, and therefore they weren't entitled to the costs. So she did leave that door open and then subsequently denied the costs. Did that answer the question, Your Honor?
Maybe.
This reminds me of the argument yesterday at the Supreme Court of the United States where they're arguing when and means and or. Just saying. Good job. I'm not faulting anyone.
Thank you.
Mr. Cogburn.
Thank you. I believe Justice Pickering is correct. It is an ambiguous offer when you state lump sum and then go on to state exclusive of interest, fees, and cost. That does make it ambiguous, and that's where you return back to. If it's ambiguous, it's construed against the person that makes the offer.
What do you do with the pushback that it's a penalty, swinging fees and costs, and therefore you don't do it that way?
You have to read the rule as a whole. You can't put one part of the rule in a vacuum and say, hey, here, we paid the offer. And that's very key when it says we paid the offer within the 21 days. The offer is $150,000 exclusive of fees, interest, and cost. So it doesn't say that we paid the judgment. It doesn't say that we paid the amount listed. It says the offer. And the offer in whole is $150,000 in the $1 exclusive of fees, cost, and interest. And when you look at historically and you look at the case law, you're allowed to petition for, if we were entitled to fees under a contract or something, that would have been allowable, but here it is not at play. We're allowed to petition for cost and we're allowed to petition for prejudgment interest.
I have a problem with D1, 2, 3, with 1 and 2 establishing this dismissal mechanism with no allusion to the court fixing costs and interest. And then 3, you started with that, and I appreciated your candor on that. But how do we deal with that?
I agree with you. I would say I don't think it's the best written rule. And when we amended them in 2019, I wish we would have made it a little bit clearer. I agree 100%.
Me too.
But I think
Kadish and I were on that committee. I wish I wrote it better. Sorry.
But I think the intent goes back to when you can look at the 98 amendment, which is, hey, you can pay it so there's not a judgment entered. But you need to pay what the offer is. If it's exclusive of interest, you calculate the interest. If it's exclusive of cost, you can have a discussion with counsel over cost and go, they can, you know, you try to work that out. And oftentimes you'll work out a settlement agreement, even though it's within that 21 days, such as confidentiality. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very much. So this matter.